It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. School-based lead testing for thousands of Milwaukee public school students is getting underway.
After years of delays, the Milwaukee Health Department recently received a $400,000 federal grant to test children for lead poisoning.
The federal funds support expanded in-school lead screening, along with outreach efforts to parents and community members.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, is now on the ground in Milwaukee to support the effort, which aims to screen up to 8,000 students in the coming year.
This comes after the district spent about $43 million to clean up widespread lead paint hazards at 100 schools.
Richard Diaz is co-founder and chair of the Coalition on Lead Emergency. That's a volunteer-run Milwaukee group focused on preventing lead poisoning. Richard, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, thank you.
And Tyler Weber is here, Deputy Commissioner of the Milwaukee Health Department's Environmental Health Division. Tyler, thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
Tyler, there's been a lot of back and forth with this grant money after mass layoffs at the CDC last year. Now that this $400,000 grant is in place, what is it allowing you to pay for and do that you weren't able to do before?
Yeah, it's an incredible help. It's allowing us to send the money out to partners that are really doing the work. That's Novir, a local agency for blood lead testing, and then our partnership with Coalition for Lead Emergency. And this is all filtering through MPS. So now we can set up clinics weekly and monthly from now for the next 12 months. So it's a critical help in this effort.
Weekly clinics. Richard, how is this grant supporting your work with the Coalition on Lead Emergency?
Yeah, so, you know, our coalition is very pleased for the work being done in partnership with the health department and MPS. And in fact, in 2023, we formed our 501c3, the Coalesce Safe and Healthy Homes Project. That is the official partner, a part of the project. You know, we are extremely happy to help with that parental engagement and making sure that the youth in the community are tested and screened often.
Tyler, now that this team from the CDC is helping out in Milwaukee, what kind of support is the CDC providing?
So they're here this week to look at the neighborhoods, to tour the schools, to see that the work that was done and see the powerful work that Cole is doing. They've signed over 200 consents. And so the CDC now is returning this week to Atlanta, and then they're going to provide ongoing support as we get results in. How do we interpret results? How do we respond? How do we continue to support our schools and families? So it's going to be an ongoing support, and it's good to have them on the ground.
When you say over 200 consents, is that parents, guardians signing off on allowing their child to be tested?
Yeah, we can't just randomly test any child. We need the parents to sign off and consent to having their child screened.
And Tyler, the district has held several lead screening clinics so far. What kind of turnout have you been seeing?
So previously, since March of 2025, we've screened over 900 children. Some clinics very successful. Some have less of a turnout than we want. But since February, in our formal partnership with Novir and Cole, we've had excellent turnout. So we're really happy with what we learned over the last year and what's needed to screen as many children as possible when we set up the clinics.
What have you learned? What makes the difference?
Having community partners knocking on doors and talking to parents directly to say why this is important, because they'll listen to someone at Cole, honestly, more than they may listen to somebody with a government badge. So that partnership is critical.
Richard, can you talk further about that? Why do you think it's so important to have these screenings in schools rather than at, say, doctor's offices or other places in the community?
Well, the relationship between the school, the teachers and the administrators, you know, and their commitment to engaging with youth and keeping young minds healthy and safe, I think that relationship is something that makes testing at schools and in partnerships with schools a lot more practical. Also, in terms of, you know, our folks engaging, you know, we've built a model that employs parents that have children who have been lead poisoned. So they're able to relate in the way that somebody that, you know, simply knows or think it's the right thing to do, because, you know, our folks have that lived experience and that cultural competency.
Do you personally have that lived experience?
Yes, I have, various relatives that, have been impacted by lead in ways in which they haven't been able to hold full-time jobs, in ways in which, they have serious health issues. And it hits a lot differently when it's someone you know that has been lead poisoned versus, reading the news articles or reading various research studies about why lead is harmful.
Will these be lifelong struggles?
They will be. It will be lifelong struggles for the individual, and it will also be a lifelong issue for society as we continue to let more kids be lead poisoned. Milwaukee was smart in the way that it used its American Rescue Plan Act dollars to dedicate resources to lower the blood action level that triggers investigations. But, we're at a pivotal time where the city will need to think through what is our contingency plan once this federal cliff hits at the end of 2026 and the ARPA money is no longer available. So, another reason why we are so fortunate for this partnership with the health department and the resources from the CDC to continue screening. So we know how much of an issue this is. Typically, the health department only has about enough resources to abate 200 homes a year. And as we uncover that more youth are impacted, we can make a case for why more resources are needed and have evidence to show that mm-hmm. more abatement and primary prevention is needed.
We're talking with Richard Diaz, their co-founder and chair of the Coalition on Lead Emergency, and Tyler Weber, Deputy Commissioner of Environmental Health with the Milwaukee Health Department, as we look at efforts underway in Milwaukee to test children for lead poisoning after Milwaukee Public Schools stabilized lead paint in 99 elementary school buildings last year. Tyler, the grant covers screenings for up to 8,000 students in Milwaukee Public Schools, but we know the district has more than 65,000 students. How is the health department working with the school district to prioritize which students to screen and prioritize?
We're a childhood lead poison prevention program, and under state law, it's under the age of six. And biologically lead, the younger someone is poisoned, the more impact it could have long-term on their life. And so we're starting with the youngest children first in the district and then seeing what other additional resources we can get to continue screening even post the CDC grant. So the CDC grant is a big boost to get us started with the youngest, most vulnerable children. And then what do we need to keep doing to expand that to potentially older ages later on?
Would the youngest children be your 4K students or your kindergarten?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so almost 100 elementary schools had lead problems that were cleaned up by the end of last year. Huge effort. If the students at all of these schools got tested, it would be far more than this grant provides for. Do you think is more needed?
Yes. I mean, Milwaukee, overall, we have a lot of lead in our environment. We know from this past year it's in our schools. It's also in our homes and soil. And so there's a lot of work that's needed to clean up our city. And there's a lot of work needed to continually testing as much as we can our most vulnerable population, our children.
Richard, how are parents kept in the loop about their child's lead levels? And what should families know when they look at these screening results?
They should know that, harm has been done if your child is determined to have an elevated blood lead level. We have a great partnership with Children's Hospital, which, we partner with them on a cooking with coal event where families can come in and learn various recipes and cooking techniques and forms of nutrition to keep yourself safe and protect yourself from childhood lead poisoning. But our families are mostly interested in seeing continued services ramp up. DHS released a report in 2014 that stated that lead poisoning is more of a poor school performance indicator than poverty or class size. Hmm. So, these partnerships with the health department, MPS, and the hospital systems are happening and have to happen if we hope to save more children.
Tyler, talk about those next steps. If lead is detected during one of these screenings for a child, what are the next steps taken by the health department?
Yeah, so next step is we're calling every positive test. We have a nurse team. We also have a home inspector team that are all qualified lead risk assessors. So there's the higher the lead level, the stronger intervention is. But we'd like to get a home visit for each with the nurse for each child that tests positive, and then see what resources we have to go beyond that.
Could it be other things in that child's environment, or could lead be compounding for that child if it's, you know, a school issue, a home issue?
It could be any combination of all the above, and that's why conducted investigations are so critically important, where we take dust wipe samples at home and we use a X-ray analyzer to determine where lead is on the walls or in surfaces. We look outside. So there's a lot extensive work that we do, especially at the higher lead levels, to not only detect the lead, but then invest in controlling it and making it a safe environment. So there's a lot of work that goes into what happens and caring for the family and supporting the family over such a challenging time.
Richard, from the view of your coalition, what would success for this testing effort look like as you look down the road here?
Yeah, I think long term, right? Like we've had some preliminary discussions with NPS well before the various lead investigation and abatement efforts to see if the schools can mandate lead tests be performed for youth, and if, you know, families don't have those tests done, being able to set up on-site opportunities, making it more systemic and across various departments at NPS, being able to have lead poisoning be a focal point of how the school system cares for its youth. I think also standing up clinics in the places that are the most vulnerable, right? Like we are very grateful that a private partner like Novir can step up, right? But it can't just be Novir. And in order to meet the problem at scale, we're going to need a lot more hospital systems and
to step up. Yes. Richard and Tyler, thank you so much for joining us. That is Richard Diaz, co-founder and chair of the Coalition on Lead Emergency. Tyler Weber, deputy commissioner of the Environmental Health Division with the Milwaukee Health Department.
Coming up, many Wisconsin communities face population declines and low economic growth. A Wisconsin author says targeted immigration programs could turn things around.
There's this kind of synergy to immigrants working alongside non-immigrants to actually kind of grow the economy. And you see economic growth and employment growth from that synergy.
That's ahead on WPR News. Now, population growth is slowing nationwide and in Wisconsin, and that's mostly because of a historic decline in immigrants coming here from other countries, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. In Wisconsin, the number of international migrants coming to the state fell by more than 62% in 2025.
Combined with an aging population and a declining birth rate, this could mean a lower overall population. The Wisconsin Department of Administration has projected that the state will lose nearly 200,000 residents over the next 25 years.
That trend could make a labor shortage that's already being felt in some industries even more pronounced in the future, slowing down the state's economy.
So how could Wisconsin reverse the trend? A population geographer says immigration reform could be the answer.
Jonathan Burkham is associate professor of human geography at UW-Whitewater, where he researches the intersection of economic development and migration. His new book is called Migrant Midwest, The Case for Immigration and Economic Growth in the American Heartland. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Rob.
Well, as I'm reading your book, we get this new Census Bureau data out showing that the whole country is experiencing a slowdown in population growth. What does that look like here in Wisconsin, in the Heartland, as you call it, and what are the factors behind that?
Well, Wisconsin, really like a lot of the states in the Midwest and to a certain degree in the Northeast, has been really kind of struggling with fairly slow population growth, you know, for at least a decade now. And in some states, the population has already started to decline, right? So these trends have been around for a while. And you know, this current trend of kind of national population stagnation, you know, it's largely driven by this, you know, this drop in immigration that we've seen over the last year, and including the deportations that we've seen. So on the one hand, right, we're seeing declining immigration in the country as well as in the state. But then there's also these kind of more baked in trends of, you know, fertility decline. The fertility rate, the average number of children a woman has really dropped in the last decade in particular.
You talk about something you call a demographic winter on the way for states like Wisconsin. Absent that immigration, what do the next couple few decades hold?
Yeah, so demographic winters, I kind of define it as the economic and social conditions of kind of population stagnation and decline, right? And so, again, this is driven by, you know, these factors, right? Kind of fertility, immigration, as well as domestic migration. And in the case of Wisconsin, right, we are still a fairly low immigration state, so we don't have a large number of international migrants living in the state as a share of our population, right? I mean, it's about 7% of the population, a little bit lower, actually. And we also have a history of domestic out-migration. In other words, people leaving the state of Wisconsin, mostly going down to the Sun Belt. That's stabilized a bit in the last few years. But we've seen a lot of domestic out-migration. And then in terms of, again, fertility, we haven't seen, birth rates are quite low. And so we don't see kind of a source for population there. And this creates real challenges for a lot of communities that are already in decline, right? And that comes along with all kinds of fiscal challenges for governments. And something that I focus a lot on in my book is the labor market conditions and the difficulty in finding people to fill positions across a range of industries.
And that's a real key to your book, this idea that especially maybe in particular communities, rural parts of the state, but also big cities in the Midwest, you've got this population trend where you have lots of older people out of the workforce, fewer people of that working age, fewer people moving into the working age. What are some of those main challenges when we hit that balance?
Yeah, so, I mean, interestingly and concerningly, Wisconsin has seen in the last year, for the first time in its history, apart from COVID, absolute labor force decline. In other words, we have about 50,000 to 60,000 fewer people in the workforce than we did a year ago. And, you know, even prior to that decline, we have industries, manufacturing, agriculture, healthcare, in which these industries are really struggling to find workers. And so this is going to really slow down, I would say, economic growth in the state and, you know, present some real challenges. I mean, if you think about it, we have this baby boomer population that has been moving into retirement for some time and will continue to over the next 5 years or so. And it's going to create, you know, a real demand for healthcare jobs. And so we're just struggling to provide enough workers to fill those jobs. You know, I see in particular home health aides is one of the fastest growing, employment sectors in the state. And so, you know, where are these workers going to come from?
We're talking to Jonathan Burkham from UW-Whitewater about his new book, Migrant Midwest, The Case for Immigration and Economic Growth in the American Heartland. Let's dig into that case now. You see immigration done right as giving us the prospects of an economic boom and helping to reverse that demographic winter you're worried about. Make that basic case.
Yeah, so again, these other things, these other trends that are contributing to demographic winter are a little bit stickier, in particular, right, fertility rates. So we're not likely to see much of a growth, driven by fertility rates. Fertility rates have been at historic lows, really for several decades below kind of replacement rate. Right. And so with fertility rates low, you know, we could rely somewhat on domestic migration. But again, you know, the trends have been that many Wisconsinites have been leaving, and we aren't seeing a lot of people flooding into the state. And so this really leaves international migration as the primary driver of population growth in the state of Wisconsin and really the nation as a whole. And so today's immigrants actually are from a wide range of kind of education levels and from a diversity of countries. And so they're coming in and they're filling all different types of positions in local economies. And if we're going to continue to see the state's economy grow and the national economy grow, right, we're going to need this labor force to fill these different positions.
Part of how you want to do that is very different than how our immigration system works right now. It is, of course, a federal responsibility to manage immigration. You would like to see a policy sometimes called heartland visas that say, hey, states and localities that want and need immigrants to fill these needs, well, maybe we can work with them to do that. And you even point to Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson offering a proposal along those lines. What would that look like?
Yeah, sure. So Ron Johnson, yes, Senator Johnson, he proposed a state-based visa sponsor program in 2017. And it was modeled somewhat similarly to a system Canada has in place. And what it does is it allows states to opt into a pool of employment-based visas. And what's really, I think, kind of exciting about this proposal and just this overall idea for these state-based visas or even the Heartland visa is it allows states to kind of tailor those immigrants, those workers, right, to particular industries, right? So we could prioritize, say, in the state of Wisconsin, workers to work in the dairy industry, or we could prioritize folks to come in and work in healthcare. We could prioritize manufacturing. I mean, manufacturing, if you look at employer surveys, they've been, claiming for decades now that they just can't find enough workers to fill those jobs in the manufacturing sector, right? So we could tailor our specific allotment of visas, right, to favor people with the certain skills that are needed in those industries.
A common concern is, and this has come from the left and the right over the years, is, hey, wait a minute, if we're bringing in more laborers, well, that reduces the value of labor. It's going to bring wages down in general for everybody. You dig into the economics behind that, it gets complicated. Ultimately, you say, no, that isn't necessarily the case.
Yeah, it's not necessarily the case. And so this phenomenon, right, is what we refer to as wage suppression, right, where you have immigrants coming into a particular industry and then kind of, driving down the wages in that industry. And you just, the data just doesn't support that. This study, or there have been numerous studies that have looked into this phenomenon of wage suppression and found that, by and large, immigrant workers come in as kind of like complementary workers that end up creating more jobs and often, creating jobs that then the native-born labor force may move into. And so there's this kind of synergy to immigrants working alongside non-immigrants to actually kind of grow the economy. And you see, economic growth and employment growth from that synergy.
As we wrap up, you point out there can be cultural concerns, right? If there's large groups of people coming in from another country into a community, how could, say, a rural Wisconsin region successfully balance those two needs, wanting those immigrant laborers, not wanting the locals to feel like, hey, wait, this is a different place than I grew up in?
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for kind of cultural integration efforts. I mean, I think a lot of small town and, big city mayors are actually very aware of this. And, they recognize these demographic challenges that their communities are facing, and they recognize that immigrants are going to be a really big part of kind of sustaining and stabilizing those communities. And so, mayors working with, local churches, schools in particular, to find ways to integrate this population into and kind of create spaces where they can communicate and spend time with the native-born population. So a lot of these maybe concerns about the cultural challenges can dissipate from that contact. And I'd also like to add that, you know, this state-based visa sponsor program does allow states to not opt into this set of visas, right? And so if a community is feeling or a state is feeling like collectively, right, that they have, you know, that immigration has gotten to be a problem and they feel like there are maybe too many immigrants in that state, right, they could opt out of those particular sets of visas, right? And so it kind of takes the power away from the federal government and to a certain degree hands it to, you know, people in the state.
Jonathan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Jonathan Burkham, Associate Professor of Human Geography at UW-Whitewater, been talking about his new book, Migrant Midwest, and why he believes immigration is an important piece of the puzzle as Wisconsin is predicted to see a sharp population decline between now and 2050.
Coming up, thousands of black bears call Wisconsin home, and the DNR is looking for help in locating their dens so they can have a look.
Crawling into a bear den with animals is certainly one of those things your body will warn you is not a good idea, right?
A DNR biologist on the health of the bear population. That's next from WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
Have you ever wondered what a bear cub sounds like? Have a listen to this, courtesy of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources.
So cute. Bear cubs, they're making those sounds in dens all around the North Woods as they cuddle up with their moms. Once a rarity in Wisconsin, about 24,000 black bears now live in the state.
The DNR has been conducting a years-long survey of the animals to better understand how many live here and how healthy they are.
To learn more about the study and what people should do if they encounter a bear in the wild, we turn to Jennifer Price Tack. She is a large carnivore research scientist with the state DNR. Jennifer, welcome.
Hi, Kate. Thanks so much for having me today and your interest in this research.
Yes, you've been surveying bear dens in the past few weeks. Is it a little bit scary crawling into a bear den?
Indeed. Yeah, we started a few weeks ago, and it is a little bit scary. You know, crawling into a bear den with animals is certainly one of those things your body will warn you is not a good idea, right?
Why do you need to enter the den in the first place, and could you send a camera in?
Absolutely. So we actually are going in the den so that we can immobilize the adult female bear and any young yearling, so 1-year-old bears that are with her. And that's because we need to get her out and deploy a collar onto her. And that's to help support this research that we're doing in Wisconsin to better understand reproduction of black bears, how it affects the population, and how that in turn affects management decisions such as quotas.
Can you describe what these dens are like? What do you see?
Sure, absolutely. Each den is unique. It's kind of amazing the diversity of dens that we see. Some of them are under root balls. Some of them are dug into the side of hills. We even have individuals that create a little nest on top of the ground and then, you know, stay there all winter.
How do you find these dens, or where? How do you find the bears?
Yeah, that would be very challenging. But luckily, we have an amazing public here in Wisconsin, and a lot of people send us reports of bear dens once they happen upon them. Maybe they were hiking and saw it. Maybe their dog came across it. But they take a picture of the location. They send us a GPS location. And then my team goes out and takes a look at the den to assess to make sure it's still in use. And then whether or not it's one that we could incorporate into our research study.
And so as you incorporate more bears into your research study, what are you looking for as you examine mother bears and her cubs?
So what we are looking for is to update information that we have on litter size, litter frequency, and cub survival. So we're looking for any female, but we're ideally trying to get them distributed across bear range, which is the largely the northern portion of the state. But increasingly, these bears are traveling further south and setting up residences further south as well. So we have a lot more bears in the north than we have collared. And so we're always looking for opportunities to get collars on bears in more southern regions.
So does your research at all help us better coexist with bears? Because isn't the population expanding?
The population is expanding. It's kind of incredible. Bears definitely a success story for Wisconsin. So what we're learning is really about how they're reproducing and how that's going to affect the population and management decisions. And simultaneously, we're working with collaborators at UW-Madison to better understand the diets of these animals. And that in turn can help us to better guide how people can live with bears without as much nuisance, for example. So we're learning things about, you know, our bears that have larger litters, also the bears that are utilizing more human food, more trash, more, you know, corn, things like that.
What type of food do the bears prefer?
So bears do prefer natural food, and that can include things like sedges or grasses. It also includes hard mass like acorns, that's very popular, berries, etc. They're omnivorous, so they have a really wide-ranging diet. And it's kind of similar to humans, actually. We're a little bit of everything, if you will, and then also animal protein.
So would their population expand in the direction of where they are finding the most food? Do those two interconnect?
Sure. What we are finding is that bears are just this incredible resilient animal, and they're finding food wherever they are. And so depending on where they are, they may have a different proportion of food that is from mast producing trees like oaks, or they may utilize cornfields more. So we do have a lot of bears in Wisconsin that actually like to get into cornfields. And I say they're like panda bears, you know, they will plop down in a cornfield and pull stalks toward them. And that's great. Yeah, it's great for a bear, right? That's this amazing corn buffet for them. But you can imagine it's not great for the corn producers and our farmers in the state. So a lot of the work of the state is to find a balance with bear management on ensuring that bear populations are healthy, that they can be harvested. They're very popular harvested species, but also that we're doing our due diligence to the farmers in the state and trying to minimize that damage and ultimately that loss of profit.
Are you able to relocate bears that are a nuisance to perhaps crops or livestock?
Absolutely. Wisconsin has a very robust abatement program for bear. And so the work of that program is to work with different farm producers and actually develop plans and strategies to help reduce bear damage. One of our projects related to this reproductive project is actually looking at the effectiveness of those abatement measures.
You said earlier you use citizen scientists to help you locate these bear dens that you're checking out. People notify you if they find bear dens in Wisconsin. What information specifically are you looking for?
Sure. So most importantly, we need a location. We need a location and then, of course, permission from whoever found the den. You know, if they're a private landowner, then we want to make sure that they're okay with us coming out to their property. We also ask people to submit a photo. That way we can get a better gauge of where that den's located. As you can imagine, it can be very challenging to find these dens, especially after we get a lot of snowfall. So those reference photos really help us to pinpoint and more efficiently find the den.
How helpful are these reports that you get?
These are pivotal for us. So we can't actually do this project without the help and support of the folks who report bear dens. My team is very small. There are just a few of us, and we would not have the capacity to go out and find these dens. And so working with the public is really great because it helps us get more dens, but it also provides this really amazing collaboration with those individuals. And we invite them out. If we do are able to do a successful den, then we'll bring them out with us, a couple of, you know, maybe 1 to 3 people, show them what we do and walk them through the full process.
Oh, how cool. So when you have a successful den and you've collared another bear and her cubs and you have to take those animals out of the den, can you talk about how hard that is to get bears out of their den?
Absolutely. It can be quite the challenge. So one of the most important pieces of the project or of a den survey is the assessment work. So one of my team members will actually go out beforehand, check out the den and come up with a strategy. You know, what kind of den is this? How many people are we going to need? How difficult is the extraction of that adult female going to be? So then when we get the team there, we're usually very prepared. We know exactly what we're going to need and we're able to implement the survey well. So when we actually get there, we go in, we do the immobilization, and we need an interesting diversity of people usually to get these surveys done well and have the extraction go well. We've got some long and lean people that are able to reach down deeper into the den. We've got some strong people that can help with the extraction itself. And a lot of the magic comes in positioning the bears. And so we actually call it a Superman pose. And that's where we have the animal's arms extended out in front of it. Mm-hmm. And that helps to slide the bear out of the den with minimal, you know, effort or pulling on that animal. Because it is still an animal and we want to be really careful when we're handling it.
And do you have any tips for people if they would encounter a black bear in the wild? What should they do?
If you encounter a black bear in the wild, the smartest thing to do is to get big and make a lot of noise. These are still wild animals and they can pose a safety threat. So you want to be really careful. You know, don't approach the bear. Try to get big. Try to scare it off. That's the smartest thing to do.
Jen, thank you for sharing your research.
Yeah, thank you so much. Really appreciate chatting with you.
Jennifer Price Tack is a large carnivore research scientist with the state DNR, and we've been talking about the health of the bear population in Wisconsin and a years-long study to better understand what their lives are like in our state.
Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.